Case number 20-1512 et al. Sierra Club et al. Petitioners versus Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Mr. Luckett for the petitioners, Mr. Estes for the respondent, Mr. Marwell for the interveners.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Luckett, please proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Benjamin Luckett and I represent the petitioners. Reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal, please. After my brief introduction, I'll first address the court's mootness and abeyance questions before moving on to them. Since the 2017 issuance of the Environmental Impact Statement and Certificate of Public Convenience and Necessity for the Mountain Valley Pipeline, significant new factual developments have severely eroded several of FERC's fundamental conclusions supporting its authorizations of the pipeline. For example, in contrast to FERC's rosy predictions that pipeline construction would cause only minimal sedimentation impacts to streams and wetlands, in reality, the project has led to widespread erosion and sedimentation failures that have buried water bodies in mud and otherwise led to numerous violations of state water quality standards.
I'm sorry to interrupt your opening. I just need clarification on one thing. Did FERC say minimal in its certification order? I thought you just said FERC.
It said that impacts can be effectively minimized.
Okay, yeah, that's different than minimal.
I believe
Sorry, go ahead.
FERC also said they would not be significantly greater than background sedimentation, runoff from natural level. And FERC's refusal to supplement its EIS in light of that significant new information when issuing the challenged orders here was arbitrary and capricious and violated NEPA. Now, likewise, significant new information has undermined FERC's Natural Gas Act finding of market need for the pipeline. Mountain Valley originally claimed that the pipeline was needed to serve growing demand in the Southeast markets and to alleviate constraints on gas production takeaway from the Appalachian Basin. But evidence arising since 2017, including statements from the major gas utilities in the region, shows that gas demand is flat or declining, and that Mountain Valley's predictions of increased demand have failed to materialize. And moreover, new evidence shows that instead of a need for increased takeaway capacity from the Appalachian Basin, there's in fact a 3 billion cubic foot per day surplus of takeaway capacity, such that the pipeline's primary anchor shipper is seeking to get out of its capacity contracts on the Mountain Valley Pipeline. As this court made clear in Environmental Defense Fund v. FERC, FERC's exclusive reliance on the existence of those capacity contracts in the face of this sort of substantial evidence indicating those agreements are not reliable indicators of market need reflects unreasoned decision-making that render its orders arbitrary.
That was a case, though, where weren't all of the precedent agreements with affiliates?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that's not the case here.
That is correct. But the court's reasoning in that case was not limited to the affiliated nature of the agreement. The court there stressed the requirements of FERC's certificate policy statement that FERC consider all relevant factors. And it faulted FERC in that case.
That wasn't an extension decision either. That was an original certificate order.
That is correct.
All right, the extension, at least under FERC rules, only asks, is there good cause for the extension? And so it seems to me that's where the action is on that question.
Well, FERC also includes certificate deadlines because it says the information supporting its public convenience and necessity findings can grow stale with the passage of time. And thus, when it is issuing these extensions, that it is required to look back over there and confirm that that information is still viable.
So are you saying that a decision to issue an extension must meet the same legal standards as an initial decision to issue a certificate order?
FERC must confirm that the pipeline, that the project remains required by the public convenience and necessity. Now, it does not have to completely revisit its earlier decision, mm-hmm. but it has to ensure that developments since that decision mm-hmm. have not rendered its findings stale such that the project is no longer in the public convenience and necessity. Here it failed to do that.
Can you cite us a case not necessarily from us, but even from FERC, where they have declined an extension on these grounds, that basically the market need that we thought that we had previously no longer exists.
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I know that often in cases like this, where there is such strong evidence that need doesn't exist, the project will get canceled, and so such an order never comes to pass. And, you know, these years-long extensions, I don't believe are routine in FERC projects, so it's not completely surprising.
This is only such a case. It was only 2 years after the certificate order, and it was a two-year extension, correct?
Correct.
We're not talking about a lengthy passage of time between the original decision and the extension, or an abnormally long extension, right?
No, it's not.
Right. And the people who had executed these, or a number of the people, including the company that you referenced, I forget the initials, EQT, okay, came and said, no, we're still all in, and testified before FERC. So it's not as though, you know, they didn't have evidence. I understand that you had counter evidence, but again, we're only determining whether, at least you haven't challenged the good cause as the standard, that their regulations, impose that, their decisions have applied that, and you haven't challenged that as the operative standard here. So why isn't a difference in evidence? I get you have yours, they had theirs. How could we write an opinion saying 2 years on, you come up with some contrary evidence, but they come up with evidence that was upheld by this court as sufficient to issue a certificate order in the first instance, that it's still no longer good or stale, I think, in your words.
So, as for the good cause standard, petitioners view that as applying to a diligence by the app. And petitioners do not allege that MVP was non-diligent in pursuing completion. However, we see the requirement to confirm those earlier findings as a separate requirement that is, you know, arises from FERC's own precedent and its own statement. And again, in this decision, FERC failed to grapple with evidence that tended to undermine the probative weight of the precedent agreement. And that's exactly what this court focused on in Environmental Defense Fund v. FERC. They stressed that the policy statement requires FERC to consider all relevant factors, reflecting on the need for a project, including demand projections, potential cost savings to consumers, or a comparison of projected demand with the amount of capacity currently serving the market. They stressed that the policy statement states that the evidence necessary to establish the need for the project, we usually include a market study. Here, FERC dismissed all such evidence as that as merely speculative. Its policy statement tells it to consider this type of evidence and also consider precedent agreements. But in reality, what FERC does and what FERC has done here is dismiss any other evidence as purely speculative and rely exclusively on the precedent agreement. And that's what this court in Environmental Defense Fund said FERC may not do. Now, in addition to the Natural Gas Act merits claims, FERC's failure to conduct supplemental NEPA analysis in light of the pipeline's widespread erosion and sedimentation impacts that far exceeded those predicted in the 2017 EIS was arbitrary and capricious. NEPA regulations require that an agency shall supplement an EIS if there are significant new circumstances or information relevant to environmental concerns.
So they said it was caused by this historic rainfall. And if there's no reason to believe that the historic rainfall is going to recur, is that the type of thing that would be the predicate for a supplemental EIS?
I do. And
is there any case that sort of says something that a condition that something happened? And put aside whether you disagree with that explanation. Let's just take it as given for now for this question. If they say it was caused by this unexpected an unprecedented rainfall, and there's no evidence that that's going to recur in the two-year period for this extension to complete the project. Is there any case that says something that isn't expected to recur can still be cause a need for a supplemental EIS?
Your Honor, I would dispute that all of the issues here were a result.
I know, but if right, I understand that. You're not conceding that by answering this question. I'm just trying to ask the question if, because this is their view, it was caused by this rainfall. And that's not expected to recur in this 2-year period. I wasn't aware of any evidence that was put on that. Then is that still a basis for supplemental EIS? That type of surprising circumstance?
That were the only cause of these widespread failures, potentially so, Your Honor. But that I do not believe that is the case.
No, I get. I'm not asking you to agree with their vision of the facts here. I'm just asking if they're right as to that factual determination, then it wouldn't be the basis for a supplemental EIS. We'd have to reject that as the sole basis for what went wrong here.
Again, I do not believe that was the case here. And FERC's, the impacts were widespread and severe, and not only a result of historic or unprecedented rainfall events that were unlikely to occur. In contrast to FERC's predictions, miles of streams were buried in inches, sometimes up to a foot of sediment. There have been hundreds of notices of violations from state regulators, many more documented by citizen monitors. These sorts of violations have continued as long as active construction has been going on at all times. And that's not just petitioner's opinion. A petitioner cited to a letter by an expert from Virginia Tech who consults with the Virginia Department of Fish and Wildlife Service, who stated that FERC's original sedimentation analysis was intuitively unrealistic, and that sedimentation from the project threatened the endangered Roanoke log perch, and cited as evidence those recent violations by the Mountain Valley Pipe. And indeed, both the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service have revised their sedimentation analysis since FERC's 2017 EIS. FERC has not done so. FERC's dismissal of those significant impacts is only slightly different than originally predicted, runs counter to the record, and is so implausible that—
Did you argue to FERC that because these other agencies had found it necessary to revise sedimentation analysis, they should as well?
I believe that it certainly counsels in favor of doing so.
Did you argue?
Did you argue?
To FERC?
Not directly.
Did you argue it indirectly? I know what you mean by arguing
indirectly. Yes, we cited to the Fourth Circuit's mm-hmm. vacation of mm-hmm. the original, of the Forest Service's reliance on FERC's sedimentation analysis in their EIS, and okay. the fact that the Forest Got Service it. Was re-undertaking that analysis as okay. evidence that mm-hmm. analysis was faulty. As further evidence of that these were not only slightly different outcomes than predicted by FERC in the 2017 EIS, FERC originally stated that it expected strict compliance with the sort of state law requirements that Mountain Valley has routinely violated. Yet, when those violations occurred, FERC merely hand-waved them away and said, well, they've reached consent decrees with the state regulators and no further action by us is needed. That's simply not the sort of reasoned decision-making to which this court owes deference. I'll briefly address the fact that petitioner's challenge is not moot, nor should it be held in abeyance. The case is not moot because the challenge orders presently affect petitioner's rights and interests and have more than a speculative chance of affecting them in the future. Despite the Fourth Circuit's decision, the certificate remains in effect. Mountain Valley has stated that it is committed to completing the process.
Is Valley, construction underway, construction activities underway present?
No new construction activities are underway. There is maintenance of the project right of way. And, according to FERC and Mountain Valley, that maintenance causes harm to the environment that could be alleviated by a final restoration, if this court were to order that the certificate was no longer valid and such restoration was required, that would supply meaningful relief to plaintiffs' members. But however, the fact that
you're far more expert than me. I assume even if things get stopped and put on hold for a while, that the maintenance does still have to be done. Does it not to, I mean, you're not happy with what's there now anyhow with the temporary measures. So how would you be harmed by them having to do maintenance and that maybe install better measures?
Well, the court could order final restoration of all of the, vacate FERC certificate, which would require final restoration this moment of the entire pipeline corridor.
Would that final restoration process not increase sedimentation as it happens?
Maybe to some degree, but nothing like new construction would. A new construction here cannot be ruled out.
I'm not talking about new construction. I'm talking about. I thought you said, maybe I misunderstood you. I thought you said you were still injured by any sort of maintenance measures taken while things are on hold because of these other permit issues. And as to that type of maintenance, I'm not talking about complete restoration. I'm not talking about final restoration. If they build the pipeline or if they get rid of the whole pipeline, but that maintenance stuff, how does that injure your clients when you've made quite clear you're not happy with what's in place now anyhow? Why would maintenance be something that injures your clients still?
But
I might not understand what maintenance includes.
That includes, company trucks on their property and people mm-hmm. coming to maintain erosion and sediment control devices.
The presence of trucks and equipment was one of the reasons FERC gave for allowing restoration work to continue.
I would note that was FERC's for allowing full construction, not just restoration. And mm-hmm. Indeed, FERC's allowance of full construction, despite the absence of necessary authorizations like those that have been vacated by the Fourth Circuit, as one of the issues in this case. So petitioners cannot rely on Mountain Valley and FERC to prevent any further active construction, not just maintenance, based on the vacation of these authorizations. Now, petitioners certainly don't mm-hmm. believe that it would be appropriate, but FERC has said that it basically will allow whatever it believes to be most environmentally protected. And so if Mountain Valley and FERC were to determine that construction could take place outside of the National Forest, outside of Endangered Species Act habitat, which is, very similar to what they've done in the past. Their construction of Condition 9 allows them to do that. So that harm is also faced by petitioners, that both FERC and Mountain Valley could resume construction. We think that renders this case fit for resolution by the court. We would ask that if the court does decide
even if FERC were to stop construction by virtue of what's happened at the Fourth Circuit.
If FERC were to do that, I believe that the prospects of such harm would be greatly reduced. Petitioners on February 7th submitted a motion to FERC requesting that they do exactly that. So far, petitioners have received no response to that motion. FERC has not issued a stop work order. Mountain Valley, in response to that motion, or at least immediately.
And that motion was based on what happened in the Fourth Circuit?
Correct.
Yeah.
Immediately after the filing of that motion, Mountain Valley submitted a statement that it, at present, is only engaged in maintenance activities, but it conspicuously made no commitments as to its further activities or commitments not to engage in construction prior to while these necessary authorizations are not.
Just to follow up, if FERC were to issue a stop work order, I understand they haven't, and the Mountain Valley hasn't self-imposed a stop work order, then would that at least moot the challenges to the resume work order and the exclusion zone? Or maybe not moot, but at least put them in question for the time being?
I do not believe they would be moot. It would certainly lower the prospect of additional harm from new construction. Although again, I'll say compared to an order from this court requiring full restoration now because of an invalid FERC certificate, the ongoing presence of Mountain Valley Pipeline petitioners members' properties represents an ongoing.
During the time that the hypothetical stop construction order were in effect, there would be an ongoing harm? Or is it because if that goes away, then there could be an additional ground that would not have yet been adjudicated? So in the future, there could be an additional harm. Are you saying even during the time that—
Yes. Yes, as compared to an order which would require Mountain Valley to go in right now and pull up stakes, replan everything, finish what they're doing instead of in this hold pattern, that would constitute a harm. Now, we don't think it's a significant harm. We don't think it is a harm that is in any way on the level of the harm that results from active construction, such as trenching, grading, and all the other things that FERC has allowed in the absence of these mandatory authorizations. But we think it is a harm that would maintain justiciability.
Wait, when you say not significant, I'm just trying to understand, if there's a stop work order, I think the certificate order still affects their legal interests in their own land, of course, easements or property values and those types of things as well. And I guess it freezes in place whatever disruption to their land has happened, correct? And the property owner couldn't say there's a stop work order, so I'm going to go fill in this hole over here myself, right? Okay.
Have full use of it.
Make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions. Okay, we'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal. Mr. Estes, we'll hear from you, Commission.
Thank you, Your Honor. Matt Estes here on behalf of the— I'm sorry, I'm going to take off my mask. I have a soft voice. You have a hard time hearing me anyway without the mask. I'm here on behalf of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Your Honors, this case represents the Commission's responsible actions in trying to protect both the environment and landowner interests in the unusual circumstance where, after Mountain Valley had constructed significant parts of its pipeline, some of its permits were lost. I think it's significant that when the Commission allowed construction to recommence, the initial order allowed construction to commence only outside of the 25-mile exclusion zone that surrounds the Jefferson National Forest. And that's significant because the exclusion zone was the last major part of the pipeline route where land had not yet been disturbed. Trees had been felled, but that was the extent of the work in the exclusion zone. Outside, where the land had been disturbed, the chief effect of the recommencing work order was to allow trenching to be completed and filled in and final restoration and remediation. And the commission reasonably found that replacing the temporary erosion controls with these permanent measures would benefit the environment. It also would be beneficial to landowners who had partially constructed pipelines throughout running across their property. And in fact, a number of landowners had asked the commission to allow construction to recommence for exactly that reason.
Can I ask something just about this application for a stop work order? I think it's been pending for quite some time now. I take it the commission still has not acted on it?
That's correct, Your Honor. I can't speak as to why. I don't.
Is that abnormally long for a stop work order in response to court decisions?
I really don't know.
It just seems troubling that they haven't responded to decisions.
I can understand you saying that. I wish I had something useful to tell you, but I don't.
I mean, it also seems out of step with what the commission itself has done in this case, and the issues bound up in this case, because at least in the past, in this case, I think it was a Fourth Circuit issued an opinion at one point, and a stop work order came down within days.
Four days.
Yes, Your Honor, that was the Endangered Species Act permit, and the commission did immediately issue a stop work order. The permits for crossing the Jefferson National Forest were, I can't remember if they were stayed or vacated or what, but that had happened earlier. And after confirming that, it seems that the route through the Jefferson Forest would not change, the commission had allowed work to restart, I believe, in 2018, and no one objected to that time. So the fact that these same permits are now stayed again didn't, I guess, the commission is considering, but it's not yet decided whether to issue a stop work.
If they do, what would the jurisdictional consequences be?
I mean, in terms of whether the case is moot or not?
Moot, or would the commission think we should hold it in abeyance, or would the commission think we should go forward and decide?
I think in terms of mootness, I agree with the petitioners. I don't think it would be moot because the orders at issue here.
Can you speak up just a little bit into the microphone? Thank you.
That's I'm not wearing my mask.
Yeah, that's good.
I think that the orders still permit, would still be potentially effective in the future if the Fourth Circuit, if the permits are reissued by the relative agencies. And I'm going to leave it to counsel for the pipeline to explain what they intend to do about those permits, but their public statements have been that they've not yet given up on the pipeline. Now, in terms of abeyance, although we think that this court, there's nothing to prevent this court from ruling, we do understand there's questions of judicial economy that the court has to take into consideration. And in our view, if the court decides that it's not appropriate to act at this time, we believe that the proper step would be to hold the case in abeyance rather than find it moot for two reasons. One, we don't think that the case is moot. Also, if you do find that it's moot, arguably you would then have to vacate the commission's orders under the Munsingware Doctrine. And we think those orders provide important environmental protections because they do allow Mountain Valley to continue with restoration and remediation efforts, which arguably they would not be allowed to do if our orders are vacated as a result of the mootness.
Can I ask you decision. Sorry, were you done?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry.
I just have a process question that I'm a little confused about. So when a court order issues invalidating some important permit in this process, but it's not a FERC decision, it's a different agency, so you're not a direct party to the litigation. Is there an established process for what happens next? Is the company obligated to inform the commission immediately about this development? And who gets to decide whether, with that development, construction goes forward? Do they have to stop and wait? Does FERC get to make the first call on that? Or does the company get to keep doing whatever it wants to do, obviously, presumably complying with the court order? That's on it, if it doesn't, unless FERC says otherwise. Who has to speak first before anything can go forward once an order like that comes down?
Well, the process is that the company has to inform the commission of the order, which they did, mm-hmm. and then it's up to the commission to decide the effect of that order.
Right. So that's what I'd gotten that there's a description in the resume work order decision itself here. What FERC's process was, that it's FERC that decides what happens next. Once that order is reported, then FERC says whether things go forward or not. But that doesn't seem to be what's happened in this situation where you say they promptly reported, FERC has stood silent, and the company has said, well, we're going to do this maintenance stuff, but it hasn't said we have to stop construction. And so I was confused as to your description, which sounded like they have to wait for FERC to tell them what to do based on that development. And then what seemed to be happening at this stage.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, no. The commission would decide whether to issue a stop work order. But unless they issue a stop work order, then the company is entitled to keep working. Again, you're right. The additional work could not violate violate the permit. But they could not do work that the permit be required to have a permit to do. But otherwise, unless the commission issues a stop work order, then the company is entitled to keep on with the construction.
So can you talk about sedimentation and just address why it is that there doesn't need to be a supplemental EIS in light of what I think is apparent from the record, which is that there have been some issues, some significant issues?
Yes, I think there's a few points to be made with respect to that. First, as Judge Millett pointed out, the commission found that the sedimentation events were largely due to the rainfalls in 2018, and the evidence bears that out.
Is that all of the sedimentation about which they complain?
No, it's not, but the specific events that they mentioned all took place in 2018, which was the year that the historic rainfall occurred.
Okay, but the historic rainfall wasn't a full year, right? This wasn't like the times of Noah. And so the question is whether the sedimentation that they complain about most specifically sedimentation occurred in the immediate wake of such a rainfall? Because just saying there was a lot of rain in 2018 doesn't seem responsive to me.
Well, I think I'm not positive about the exact cause and effect in terms of the rain, but the record does show no specific claims of sedimentation in 2019 or 2020.
But the commission used that rainfall as the reason for the sedimentation, but I didn't see this particularized causation that the sedimentation happened in this week or this month, whichever it was that had the excessive rainfall, and it didn't happen when you didn't have excessive rainfall. So what was the basis for them concluding that, at least as to some of these sedimentation incidents, they were caused by the rainfall? You can't just go 2018. Some point in 2018, there was a lot of rain. That must explain all the sedimentation problems in 2018.
But the commission didn't say more than that in its orders. But remember, it has compliance monitors who are consistently reporting to the commission on these kinds of events. And in addition,
we're reviewing their decision. We're not reviewing their process. We're having people report to them. So it actually makes it worse, right? If they have this constant stream of information coming in and yet they couldn't connect the dots in their decision, then it seems to me it doesn't make sense to say if you look across the course of an entire year, there was a historic amount of rain, but without pinning that down to the sedimentation events. And these sedimentation events, or these five major sedimentation events, occurred in the immediate wake of that rainfall.
Well,
didn't they have to do that for it to even be a reason?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Not when there were no events in the subsequent 2 years. And remember, this case is not about Mountain Valley's compliance in the past with its mitigation requirements. The case is about whether this information would affect the decision-making the commission had to make going into the future. And the fact that the specific sedimentation events took place in 2018 and not after that suggests that the commission was correct that it was due to the unpredictable weather. Similarly, the petitioners also cited to a number of notices of violation.
I just want to follow up. When the commission says that it's just this terrible environmental problem was a result of something, does it have an obligation before it makes that statement to undertake the causal analysis? Or does it just get to say those things, and if someone doesn't come disprove them, then we'll take it as true?
It has to provide some explanation, which it did here, that there was significant rain events.
No, but they made a causal conclusion. They didn't just report the fact of a lot of rain that year. They made a causal connection. And so I'm assuming when the commission makes a causal connection, it has an evidentiary empirical basis for that causal connection.
It did not.
And if the evidentiary basis was there was a lot of rain that year, then we can review that and decide if that's a reasonable causal finding. If they say it was at the time of these events, or close in time to these events, preceded closely in time these events, that would be another type of causal finding we could review.
Well, as you've noted, the commission did not say that it was, did not do the kind of time and timing analysis you've mentioned.
Is it paragraph 39 on 1099 and 1100 that's the relevant place? There's nowhere else we should be looking, right?
That's correct. That was the statement. But they explained this was based on the reporting that they got from their monitors. I think it's also important to note that the commission also said that the sedimentation events were only slightly greater than they anticipated. They didn't say this was a horrible result, but don't worry, it was due to the unpredictable rain. They said it was only slightly greater than anticipated.
Well, the environmental impact study said it anticipated that dry open cut water body crossings would increase downstream turbidity, but the magnitude of the increase is minimal compared to increased turbidity associated with natural runoff events. So what the EIS said is it's going to be minimal compared to what you would get from nature anyhow. And so the question is, if as a result of the evidence that you've discovered and what's been presented to you, evidence presented to you, and I guess your monitors are giving you information as well, and the evidence of all these investigations and violations by the two states that this pipeline is crossing, the commission's position is that there was not evidence that the amount of sedimentation here was minimal compared to what you would have if there were no construction at all, just as a matter of nature?
Your Honor, that finding about minimal compared to natural runoff related only to dry stream crossings. Mm-hmm. This sedimentation wasn't from dry stream crossings. This was sedimentation from the construction along the route of the pipeline. And with respect to that,
what did the EIS say about how much sedimentation damage would come from that?
What it said in paragraph 176 of the certificate order was that the commission found that there would be a certain amount of sedimentation. All it said was that the mitigation measures would reduce that sedimentation.
That's rather improvised. What I said is, what did the environmental impact statement on which commission predicated its decision say about sedimentation risks from all the other construction?
I can't remember exactly what it said, Your Honor, but it was the language was similar to what the commission concluded in the certificate order, that there would continue to be some sedimentation, but that I believe that environmental impact statement said there would not.
I don't know what some sedimentation means. I don't even understand how that gives anybody fair notice or an understanding of what the risk is.
The commission did not.
Right, a volcano can erupt and someone will say, there's going to be some ash.
Right, but what the.
And that could be covering your house and no one can breathe. And that could be a few flakes coming down. I just don't think that's the type of. The problem with that, with the commission using language like that in a certificate order is it means nothing. It means everything and it means nothing.
Said that the amount of mitigation would reduce the sedimentation to amounts that would not lead to significant impact.
Right, but then that's the problem, is that the measures that were taken, as it turned out, didn't have that effect. And at least the two states involved were deeply troubled by this. And
Can I speak to the violations? Because I think mm-hmm. there's an important point to be mm-hmm. made there as well. The violations, likewise, most of them were in 2018. There were more in 2019, most in the first half. But the last one was in December of 2019, 10 months before this order. And as the commission noted, that Mountain Valley had entered into consent decrees with both states that were intended to resolve their concerns. And in fact, the Virginia Attorney General, in a press release quoted by the petitioners at page 43 of their brief, trumpeted that the agreement with Virginia led to important new measures that protected the environment, safety, and health. And I think the fact that the violations petered out and appear to have stopped in 2020 bears out the commission's conclusion that those resolutions in the consent decrees were effective.
No, but I think the question here, and I take your point, but I think I'm not sure it helps, because the certificate order was predicated on Mountain Valley said they're going to do X, Y, and Z. And when they do that, it won't be significant sedimentation. Well, then things went south for a lot of reasons. There's debates about the causation for some of them, at least. But things went south. And there were a lot of damaging sedimentation, or that's the evidence before the commission. So much so that two states are filing a long series of complaints and entered into a settlement agreement that requires the adoption of, I think your quote was, important new measures. Now, doesn't that show that the certificate order's original determination wasn't sufficient, either because what Mountain Valley thought would work didn't work, or Mountain Valley's compliance measures weren't complying with the requirements of state law? They had technical violations and they had substantive violations, all of which are profoundly changed circumstances. And the fact that the states thought we had to have important new measures suggests that, in fact, the measures that the certificate order rested on were not sufficient. Or conditions were way worse than weren't sufficient for conditions as it turned out in reality. Why isn't that the basis for needing a new supplemental environmental impact study?
Because again, Your Honor, the question wasn't whether in the past mitigation measures worked or not. The question was, were the mitigation measures working at the time that.
Which mitigation measures? The ones required by the certificate order or the ones required by somebody else?
The ones required by the certificate order and the ones Mountain Valley put in place as a result of the consent decrees.
Where do we have the commission looking at that, at what was required, and saying, oh, yeah, that was a problem, but we're confident these are good enough? Because as I read the commission's decision, they said they did a settlement, nothing for us to do. That seems to me an arbitrary type of reason, as opposed to go, hang on, there's multi-million dollar settlements. We need to look at what's going on here and we need to assure ourselves, but that's not what happened.
Well, but the record showed no more violations.
That's not my point. My point is that the question for the supplemental environmental impact study is whether FERC's environmental impact study and FERC's certificate order relying on that could continue to rely on that, unless, maybe I'm wrong. Is there a principle that if other entities find problems and impose new measures, find significantly changed circumstances, and they impose their own means of addressing them, that that absolves the commission or any agency from having to do a supplemental EIS? Maybe I'm not aware. That might be my mistake.
Well, I don't know if there's that principle, but there is the principle, again, that the commission had to decide what would happen in the future. And the fact that there were no sedimentation events cited for 2020, and there were no notices of violations cited for 2020.
But the commission didn't, I mean, unfortunately, for this strand of the argument, we need to review what the commission in fact said, and not what the commission could have said. And let's just engage with me on this hypothetical. Suppose the commission didn't say anything about unpredictability of rainfall, and we just assume that the events that had happened before are going to continue. Let's just assume that. And then there's this question about the state violations, and the commission says exactly what it says on 1077 and 1078, that Mountain Valley reached consent decrees to resolve violations of state environmental standards and regulations, and no additional action by the commission is necessary at this time. I mean, so one way to do it would be to say, well, even though these amazing rainfalls are going to continue into the future, the state's got it. We showed that the state reacted the first time, state's got it going on in the future, even if we assume that they're predictable, and therefore the commission doesn't need to do anything by virtue of a supplemental EIS. I take it that you don't think that that would be okay.
It certainly would be a closer case.
Well, how would it even be close? I mean, if all that the commission said was, if we take as a given that the rainfall is going to continue at the same pace as before, it's not unpredictable, because I'm just assuming that away for present purposes. And then the commission's rationale is, I'm sorry, let me just layer into this, that the challengers say, and look how bad it's been, that even the states have even said that there's been violations. And then the commission's response is, right, the state said there were violations and there was a consent decree, and therefore it's taken care of. So even though the rainfall is going to continue into the future, we can trust the state to make sure that this is all going to be dealt with. I think that would be hard to see how the commission could say, and therefore there's no need for a supplemental EIS.
Well, in your hypothetical, was there no evidence of sedimentation events or violations in the year 2020?
Well, I guess I don't know, because the commission didn't say anything about that. So I don't know that the commission would have relied on that basis. I don't know whether that was a basis of the challenge. I'm just looking at what the commission said. And what the commission said about the states is that Mountain Valley entered into consent decrees and no additional action by the commission is necessary at this time. And I guess I'm just puzzled as to why the fact that states took actions necessarily means no commission, no further action by the commission is necessary vis-a-vis a supplemental EIS, regardless of what we may think in terms of the reliability and predictability of the same events occurring in the future.
Well, I have to concede that would be a much harder case for me if I had to argue that.
And then you're bringing into play some other considerations, and I guess what's tricky about that for our purposes is that's not what the commission rested on in its decision that we're reviewing. It said, I think the relevant sentence is only the one that I quoted. If there's something else that I'm missing, tell me, but I think that's it.
That is it, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think another important point, again, is that in the order in which the commission addressed these arguments, it only allowed construction to take place outside of the exclusion zone.
That's true.
And it said that the construction it was allowing would actually reduce sedimentation. So the evidence of sedimentation that occurred while the ground was being disturbed isn't necessarily relevant to the decision to allow the restoration and remediation to take place. And in fact,
what that seems to say to me, it's an important point for us to consider, is that it's possible that restoration would improve things. But then there's still the question of whether there still should be a supplemental EIS because there's more improvement that needs to be taken into account and factored into the certificate analysis.
Well, but at that point, taking the time to do an additional EIS, potentially, and I think this is what the commission was concerned about, would result in more of the very problem that the petitioners were complaining about, because the temporary erosion controls would stay in place during the time that they were doing the study, when by allowing the construction to commence, the commission allowed those temporary controls to be removed and the ground finally restored and remediation put in place. Now,
but that answer also wouldn't address whether, if there is construction authorized going forward, as opposed, that wouldn't address, if you were to rely on that rationale that all they did was authorize restoration or more permanent protections, that wouldn't help to the question of whether any future construction could be authorized without a supplemental EIS.
Well, again, the almost all of the ground outside the exclusion zone, which is what this order permitted.
No, I'm just asking the question. The rationale you've provided wouldn't speak. There's still construction to be done on this pipeline, correct?
You mean new disturbance of the ground? Yes. And that was mostly in the exclusion zone. Mm-hmm. And with respect to that, the reason that the commission did not allow that construction in its first order was that Mountain Valley hadn't provided enough information on what the effects of sedimentation would be from that construction. Mm-hmm. However, Mountain Valley then came back with evidence that showed two things. First, it showed that any sedimentation from that construction would not flow into the Jefferson Forest, nor would it go into water bodies that would go into the Jefferson Forest. That evidence also showed some sedimentation into water bodies outside of the forest, but that sedimentation would be relatively minor. And it's significant that no party contested that evidence that Mountain Valley submitted. They did not contest it before the commission ruled granting the construction in the exclusion zone. They did not request a rehearing of that decision. It's not, if not raised it here on appeal. So I think that handles the main concern about the additional construction that would take place.
Can I just ask, do you know, was the consent decree filed with FERC? Were they able to see its terms?
I believe it was. I believe it's in the record. I could, I don't know off the top of my head mm-hmm. where it is, but mm-hmm. even if you'd like, while during the rebuttal, I can look it up and tell you.
That would be great. Is that okay?
Sure. And we can also ask Intervenors Council about that since it's their consent decree, I think. Okay.
Hey, are there?
My colleagues don't have additional questions for you, Mr. Esten. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Marwell, we'll hear from you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please support Jeremy Marwell for Intervenor Mountain Valley Pipeline. If I could start with some of the practical questions that the court had, which I think frame and are relevant to the mootness of Mayan's question, but then I would like, if I can, to also speak to the merits when we get there. There were questions.
Before you do either, do you happen to know the answer to this consent decree question?
It's on the internet, Your Honor. I'm not 100% sure if it was filed with the commission, but it's a public document.
We still need to find out about that. Okay.
Yeah, we certainly can. But that's the consent decree with.
The state one.
Yeah. Right. The state of construction is that over the past year, under the two resume work orders challenge, Mountain Valley completed a significant part of the construction in those specific areas, 17 miles of pipe installed, 18 miles of right-of-way taken to permanent restoration, were off for done, our trucks. There is still some work to be done in those two areas covered by the tourism work order, in part because we're not working in wetlands, the area covered by the Army Corps permitting, that authorization, and there is some area near the wetlands that it just doesn't make sense environmentally or otherwise to do until you can do it all at once. So there is real work left to be done, and Mountain Valley is committed to this project. It is 94% done. We are working with the agencies with regard to the Army Corps. It's been over a year. We have an application pending, but we are making forward progress. The company is committed to completing the project. For that reason and others, we think it is certainly not moot, and we would resist abeyance, in part because of the cost company of extending the period of uncertainty associated with the application. There's a problem here. We'd rather get going on it now. If not, we can put this one behind us and move forward. There's a declaration we filed in opposition to the stay motion that petitioners filed in this court, and we pointed out, among other things, that at the time it was costing us $25 million a month to maintain the temporary erosion. And that is work that we need the certificate to do. The certificate is our authorization to be on the right-of-way to replace the temporary erosion controls from time to time because they are temporary, not permanent, respond to weather events, landowner issues. And that is work we anticipate doing on a prospective basis today and every day until it's permanently restored.
Based on the consent decree, what changed in your temporary sedimentation controls?
So the best place to look at the additional protections is JA 916 and 917. And if I could just summarize that for you, there are kind of buckets of things, but there's a total of 65 additional enhancements, which I would say substantive protections, upgrades to the kinds of erosion control devices using more robust silt fence from a priority one, to a different priority, certain additional techniques. There was also a bucket of enhancements that involved additional inspections, more frequent inspections, and improvements in the process by which Mountain Valley responds to these kinds of events. And
was this information submitted to FERC? It looks like it's a letter to Interior.
It's in the record.
It's part of that.
Yeah, it's part of this record. Okay. I think everything in the court's appendix was
right.
Is from
Sorry.
The FERC record. Okay. So it's in the certified index. And if I could, I don't want to.
And so it was part of the record when they made this particular decision.
Yes. Okay. Yes. And if I could, this previous point, I think the key point on the substance for the merits of the sedimentation point. As I understand it, the agency's obligation in preparing an environmental impact statement before a shovel has gone in the ground, obviously before the project has been approved, is to try to anticipate and disclose the potential effect. Some of that you can predict based on the kind of work that's But part of that, part of what's in the EIS here, is a recognition that there are multiple layers of other protections, including state law that we have to comply with and committed to comply with, and monitors by FERC, third-party monitors that the company has to pay for who are on the site. And the EIS anticipated and talked about the role of those monitoring and the role of that enforcement. And so I think the fact that there were events, some of which were immediate response to unusual rain events, and the fact that state regulators were on the job, and the fact that we resolved those issues consensually, and that FERC did say that, it, I think shows why this is not a substantially different picture than what FERC anticipated. You can't ever predict 2 years or 3 years before you put a shovel in the ground exactly how things are going to go on every inch of a 300-mile pipeline, but FERC anticipated that these things would occur. And so I think
for the added sedimentation measures referenced that you pointed to in the appendix, were those technologies or measures that were available initially, or did they suddenly appear on the scene?
Well, so
there wasn't nothing new or revolutionary about them, I don't think.
I think that's probably fair, Your Honor. I mean, some of them have to do with the frequency of inspection. Certainly, I can't tell you that,
right.
You know, do you inspect every 7 days?
No, I meant measures imposed by the company itself.
And that's not right. Some of those are things we agreed to do as part of resolving the event. A lot of them. The other measures, I mean, I think it's fair to say that when we designed the sedimentation control plan up front in advance, we were going under FERC's own plans. These were established protocols, and FERC has thousands or tens of thousands of miles of pipeline jurisdiction. So these are essentially the best practices at the time, and we committed to doing that up front. But the
They were the best practices at the time. Sounds like these additional practices then didn't exist at the time.
Well, no, I don't mean to imply that. I guess what I mean to imply is you choose the protective measures. You scope them as appropriate for what you're doing. Here you have, you know, construction of a pipeline, which FERC has great experience with, and they balance all the relevant considerations. Some are effective with regard to some kinds of potential problems, and you would want to optimize them to the best of your judgment up front. So I don't think there's any contention that what happened up front before anybody put a shovel in the ground was inconsistent with FERC's practices at the time. But the point is they built in the possibility of being responsive to conditions on the ground as part of the original environmental review, and that's what happened. And I think it is also
But it wasn't FERC monitors finding problems that caused changes in the sedimentation protections. Whatever they were reporting, it wasn't causing any change, where the states were getting obviously quite bothered by what was going on. A large, large number by two states, a large number of violations. And I'm not here to piece through what you call technical or not, because that seems not really relevant to me. But it's whatever FERC was doing, it wasn't finding what the states were finding.
Well, I'm not sure that.
Which suggests that maybe FERC's original, maybe when it was fine at the time, but it turned out, and maybe this is very difficult terrain and difficult weather circumstances, that things changed.
Right.
And changes needed to be made. Sorry, that's all.
Yes, but I guess my point is there were multiple monitoring mechanisms built in up front. It's, as I said, FERC monitors, but also third-party monitors that we pay for who are on the route. I mean, I think there were...
No, I'm not disputing that. Oh, go ahead.
I'm sorry. No. My point was just all of that was in the mix already at the original environment.
Right, and it wasn't working. And so, right, so...
Have the states.
Well, but I mean, the states, the role of the states was in the mix in the environmental impact statement also, because...
Well, that's always there. But if the states, it just seems to me then, suppose a challenger comes in and says, look, there's now been 200 violations found by a state. It would seem like quite a response to say, that's exactly the point. That shows that the system's working.
Fair. Although I do think it would be a much harder case for us, the commission, if the states had not resolved the NOVs consensually, right? I mean, the states chose to resolve that and I do think also, just maybe technical, but what we have in the record are notices of violation, which is not a determination that we violated state law. It is sort of the first notice of a potential enforcement. And the consent decree says explicitly that Mountain Valley did not concede or admit that there were violations as part of that, you know, both sides voluntary. And I don't mean, so I think that fact that they were resolved consensually helps us in this question of whether anything is substantially different, substantially different enough that the commission would have had to take 6 months or a year, during which time the very problems that they are trying to address would continue. I mean, I think it is undisputed, and I'd like to get to the practicalities, that the temporary control devices don't work as well as permanent restoration. And that it's just a feature of having an open construction site. Revegetate, bring everything to final restoration. That is the environmental benefit the commission saw. And if I could respond to one point the petitioners made, I think was essentially, instead of doing what it did, the commission should have just said, cancel the pipeline, restore everything to final right now. That is not what was before the commission. And what the commission would have had to do is a NEPA analysis for that, a restoration plan. And that analysis, that process would have involved going back to most of these other agents who would need Endangered Species Act consultation. And in fact, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, which is another pipeline in the mix in the papers, was canceled by its project developers in July of 2020. 2 weeks ago, FERC issued an order authorizing the permanent restoration. So you have to figure out what's going to happen in areas that, that have been. I think it is a false equivalency to suggest that FERC could have, there was a different route that FERC could have taken that would have created the same benefit, which was timing, right? What they said was, we have an open construction site. We have to be responsive to the reality on the ground. And the best thing here is just to close the construction site and be done. Even if the pipeline doesn't get built and they make this finding, even if the Bureau of Land Management had not authorized us to go back across the forest, we think the best thing for the environment is to do it now. And I think that timing consideration is relevant because the reality of having an open construction site.
I don't want to keep you from getting to your point, but can I ask a fact question?
Please.
The FERC compliance officers, are their reports part of the record as well?
I believe so, yeah. I mean,
were they reporting these same violations that the states were finding?
Well, I mean, we make, certificate holder makes regular reports about incidents. So if a landowner comes to us and says, hey, I have a problem with what's happening on my property, sediment control devices failed. We put that in record.
I'm asking about the FERC compliance officers. Were they reporting to FERC the same things that these state folks must have been reporting to their higher ups, or did they just not see it?
I think part of what I don't have a record site for you to say yes. Here lines up.
Exactly. That's fine. That's a pretty particular question.
One thing to keep in mind is that you know the states have particular requirements. Some of which have to do with timing. If you have an erosion control device, you determine that this problem has to report to us within 7 days. Mm-hmm. So the points that we said where only a small fraction of these notices of violation actually involved dirt coming off the right of way, that's what we mean. And those are state law requirements. Mm-hmm. And FERC is looking at our compliance with FERC's requirements, so the plan, mm-hmm. procedures that we committed to. So, I mean, I think it's all in the mix. There was a practical question about what happens when the Fourth Circuit vacates the permit, and I'd like to be responsive to that. We did file the Fourth Circuit decision, notify FERC, mm-hmm. by the way. I think it is important to recognize that one of the recent Fourth Circuit decisions is the Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service. That is only relevant in the forest. We are not authorized to work. There's none of the orders. The resume work orders here, that's sort of within the remaining exclusion because we need that right away to do it. So that is certainly in the mix, but I think this whole case is about can we do other stuff
outside that area?
Permit. Yeah. Right. So the biological opinion is the other one, and that obviously applies anywhere we're doing work that could affect endangered species. Obviously, we're going to comply with the Endangered Species Act, but I think to understand the context of the stop work order and FERC's timing, I'm going to defer to Mr. Estes on that. But we had largely finished the forward construction work by the time we shut down for the winter, sort of colloquially say it. We had done what we could. Winter is not an optimal time to construct. Done what we could in the uplands and the rest of the area were sort of permits. So when we say we're not doing forward construction, that's because we're sort of awaiting a permit. Doesn't mean that these authorizations, there's a jurisdictional problem, as I said earlier. Still work to be done in those areas, but we are working through those other permitting. So if that's helpful in terms of context, we basically said, look, we're not doing forward construction work right now.
For seasonal reasons.
Yeah. For sort of other.
For seasonal, that's what I wanted to clarify. Is it because you can't do forward work because you don't have these permits that the stuff you would have to do now would either implicate endangered species or one of these other permits, or is there construction work you could still do that wouldn't affect, I think would not go into the forest and wouldn't affect these species. And it's April now, it's not winter.
Correct, that's fair. I don't believe, and I don't want to make a commitment to the court, I'm happy to mm-hmm. File a letter or something, but I don't believe that we are intending to do any more. The Endangered Species Act.
Because of
that, and I think also, maybe you could call it a voluntary thing, but I mean, there are areas in the uplands previously, when we mm-hmm. still had our opinion, could have worked. Mm-hmm. We said that wasn't, if it's too close to a stream, it just doesn't make sense. We get our guys in, we have machines in, mm-hmm. wait so we can run better for them. environment, it's more efficient for us. I don't know if that's helpful. I don't believe that there's an intention. The only last thing I would point out, it is not self-executing. The difference between forward construction and maintenance work, right? And sometimes it's clear if you have a temporary erosion control device that fails, you have to go and put a new one. But this, I mean, what FERC did here was make a determination that certain additional, even the open trench, close it up, feedback on and get out of there. But I think there's the overarching point about the case. FERC made a nuanced judgment about what was the right kind of work. I think a decision, a kind of analysis, definitely with the agency's discretion, what exactly. So I don't want to give an overly bright line tension.
Thank you. Let me make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you, Mr. Marwell. Thank you. Thank you for your argument. Mr. Lockett, we'll give you the 2 minutes that you try to reserve.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'd first like to point out that petitioners cited to numerous examples of erosion and sedimentation events outside of the range of unpredictable rainfall in 2018 that FERC cited, numerous notices of violation.
When did that unpredictable rainfall happen? Was it a certain month? I don't remember 2018 well enough.
I'll be honest, I don't believe FERC said in this case. I believe in the Mountain Valley Pipeline Southgate document, it cited specifically to 2018
events. You didn't have historic event rain the entire year of 2018.
No, you're
no.
In a couple months, I believe.
And do they say what months those were?
Did, but I cannot recall.
Do you remember whether those months overlapped with some of the serious sedimentation events?
They certainly overlapped with some of the major events, but by no means all of them.
Okay.
We cited significant events in August, October, November, December 2019. Mm-hmm. And now, even if all of the significant events were limited to periods of unpredictable rainfall. I'd like to clarify that petitioners do think that a supplemental EIS would still be required because FERC has yet to, in its NEPA documents, assess the impacts. Even if they're not likely to occur, they are impacts of this project. And FERC's decision-making going forward should depend on what the magnitude of the impacts of the project are. Is further construction still in the public interest? What were the impacts to aquatic life from those incidents? FERC doesn't know, the public doesn't know, because they haven't been assessed in the NEPA document. Now, the government placed significant weight on its claim that there haven't been significant incidents in 2020. But that's because there's been very little construction in 2020, up to the issuance of these orders. In late 2019, because of the Endangered Species Act issues, all construction was stopped. And you know, as for the government's claim that it was merely, you know, they seemed to intimate that their orders were merely authorizing, you know, restoration activity. But that's not true. Petitioners pointed to the fact that spread G, which includes significant steep and highly erodible slopes, was only 20% trenched at the time petitioners made their comments to FERC. And so there was still significant construction that took place as new construction with the same sorts of potential for sedimentation impacts was authorized by these orders. And Mountain Valley's council rested heavily on the consensual resolution with the state. And I'd just like to note that, you know, one factor that would quite possibly have influenced that consensual resolution, specifically with the Virginia Department of Environmental Quality, was that Mountain Valley threatened, you know, in its court briefings, took the position that Virginia had no authority to regulate and to require compliance with its erosion and sedimentation laws, and such that, you know, Virginia was not only weighing Mountain Valley's future commitments, but the litigation risk that because of Mountain Valley's claims that it had waived its Clean Water Act Section 401 authority, that the state, in fact, had no authority. So petitioners posit that that could have likely had a significant influence on that consensual resolution. And finally, I just request that if the court does choose to hold this case in abeyance, that it issue a stay of any further construction beyond maintenance of essential environmental controls.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you, counsel. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take this case under submission.
Stand, please.
Sure.
Just the complaint. The decree that I believe there is a link in the petitioner's brief where they cite the press release, and I believe that link will get you to the actual.
So I'm just wondering if FERC had it, but it sounds like it's not whether I can personally peruse it, it's whether FERC had it. And it sounds like maybe they didn't, or are you just still not aware?
I don't believe that they did, but it's not in the joint. The document I had in mind when I told you it did was not the consent decree.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you. Take this case under submission.